So this is the Living Legacy Project interview with Jody LaFond on January 23rd, 2014. Jody, thank you so much for coming in to meet with us today.
Thank you. Well, thank you for having me. Yeah.
This is the second year of the Living Legacy Project, and we're really happy that we're continuing to move forward with this project because there's so many diverse artists in the region that, you know, you can't do in just one year. And I know that we're all really excited to have you participate this year, and everyone was really stoked to have you on board. So, Jody, what inspired you to want to pursue a career in the arts or to want to be an artist?
Okay, well, when I was growing up, I sort of wanted to be an artist because maybe I thought it was cool or something. And I liked drawing and painting and got into that and started taking classes in junior high and senior high. And had a really great teacher in this summer enrichment program, Philip Morris, and he was really encouraging. But then I had sort of more staid teachers in high school that were, you know, very traditional. So that was sort of put a damper on things, and I started liking history a lot. So I started taking a lot of history classes. But then like I had an art teacher in my senior year. He brought in Tony Sisti to talk to us. And Tony Sisti went and told us not to become artists. So, yeah, I always remember that. It was very funny. That
is something. So that also indicates to me, so you grew up locally.
Yes, I grew up in Buffalo and went to Camber West, and so I took these classes. And
how fascinating, though, because he was a very successful person. You know, there's a lot of monuments to him around
town. I know. And all I can remember is him coming in and basically, you know, discouraging us, which I thought was funny.
Yeah.
Because maybe he had asked this, you know, rather traditional teacher, was there anybody in the class that had, you know, no, they're all just, you know, or something, who knows, you know, like, it was really funny that he said that. It was like maybe just money competition or something. But, you know, from a class of 30 students, I mean.
Yeah, right?
Right. You know, like we would, you know, then go to the Allentown Art Festival and see his gallery. And I think, well, he was the one that told us not to become artists.
I'm definitely not buying a painting from him.
Right. I wouldn't, yeah. So, that was funny. So then I went to school. I went to college for, you know, I was studying history. Mm-hmm. And I started taking a lot of art history just because it was, you know, actually I was still very interested in art. And then, I think I took like two art classes, like drawing classes in college, and, you know, just got like B's. I'm not that good a drawer, you know, so it's just like, okay. And then I left school, like I went to college and like for 4 years, but didn't have enough to graduate, so then I left school for a while. And then I went back, and on the off chance, like the media, The film history class was 4 or 5 credits. And I needed just distribution at this point. So I, from Brian Henderson, I took this film history class. And, you know, it was in a strange auditorium in the medical school, actually, which was odd. And there were like 20 people in this class. So it was like this huge auditorium and like 20 people in the class. And it was the second part of the film history, so it wasn't the early stuff, it was the second part. And, you know, and I was started to really, really enjoy it. And I was, you know, really sort of inspired, and then I saw that the other media studies classes had a large amount of credit hours, as opposed to, you know, like, they were, most of the university at that point was 3 credit hours, and media study classes were 4 credit hours. So I thought, well, you know, and after that, I thought, well, maybe I'll take the video class. And actually, I did, you know, I knew people who took me to hall walls and stuff like that. So I sort of knew a little bit. You know, I'd gone to some stuff.
And so about what year was this? And also, it's safe to assume...
1980, 81,
too. Okay. And it's safe to assume that you're talking about the University of Buffalo.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes, the University of Buffalo.
Yeah.
And also, what I also liked about the media study classes is that they were on the Main Street campus as opposed to the Amherst campus. You know, I mean, I can joke about it then. But I, you know, and I started and I took a intro to video, experimental video it was called, and intro to filmmaking, same, you know, because there were so many credit hours. And Chris Hill was my first video teacher, and Stephen Gallagher was my first film teacher. And I believe I also took the first half of the film history at the same time. And, you know, it was like a duck to water, you know? It was just like, you know, this made me, I didn't have to draw so well, but I could still do art. You know, I don't know if my, you know, my work in the first three classes was all that stupendous. But in fact, I remember the first film show, the student film show. I made this thing. My first tape was this called. It was called Looped Cat, and I just had this friend's cat, and he was cleaning himself, and I looped it. So, you know, it would be great on YouTube right now. and I just remember John Hand. Do you know John Hand?
Vaguely, yeah.
He was in the background, and he yelled, "Art!" He was being funny. But anyway.
Did that make the final cut?
Yeah. It was. It was fine. It was fine. And then I actually made sort of a funny little film about Niagara Falls, and people were sort of repeating actions and stuff, and that was actually rather well-received. So those were my first two, you know. And then, okay, so then I took the second half of these classes. And Tony Conrad was teaching the intermediate video, and you know, and that's when I met, like, you know, Tony, probably my biggest mentor, and he, there were these amazing classes, really, where he would always show up like an hour late for class. In fact, the class I think began at 3, and I would leave my house on Elmwood Avenue and take buses to get the UV. And I would still be early for the class. We'd still be waiting outside his classroom for the other class to end. Yeah.
So it wasn't like he was even late because...
He was still teaching.
Was talking.
Yeah, yeah, talking. He was just talking. And at that time, you could all smoke in classes. So he was smoking and we were all smoking. So that was sort of interesting. So he was just talking. And we had to make, you know, we had to bring in stuff. And at that point, I think that's when I made, like, my first big... You know, one tape that I still show is called Fruticide, and it's like I'm murdering fruit, and people really like that. And then, yeah, I was making some interesting films, too, you know. And so that sort of, you know, became familiar with, you know, everyone at Hall Walls and SIPA.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And became, you know, started just doing it. Living off, like, you know, small little student loans and unemployment. So,
making your films.
Mm-hmm. And so it was a really blissful time in my life, doing a lot of work. And then I think like 2 or 3 years later, I got like a show. Chris Hill got me a show at the Carnegie Center in North Santa Wanda. And I made some, you know, had a little retrospective of my work then. See, then I'm trying to think.
What was it like? Well, could you talk some more about your experiences with Tony Conrad as a professor and mentor?
Okay. Well, you know, he was sort of like this wild. Well, I also had Paul Sheritz as my teacher, film teacher, too. And that was a trip because he was just, you know, out of control. And, I remember taking a class with him on, like, horror movies and, you know, fantasy movies. And it was at, like, 9 o'clock in the morning, and or maybe 10. It had to be 10. It would be 9 for them. And I would go there with coffee and a bagel and just watch these really crazy horror movies. And it was fun. But he could never get the projector to work. So he would spend, like, half an hour trying to get the projector to work. And he just, like, we're just all sitting there going, "Is it gonna get the projector to work?" And he'd be swearing at it. And he goes, oh, if you guys were paying money to be here, I'd just throw this against the wall or something. I'm like, yes, do that. That'd be worth our money today. But he was, yeah, he was pretty amazingly, you know, out of control.
Sherritt's or Conrad?
Sherritt's.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tony was out of control in a different way, in a really, you know, wonderful way, that he really, you know, I think if he saw that you had something, you know, he definitely was really mentoring and rather giving of his time. And also, he was also involved in doing projects, too, and he would, you know, I definitely came and picture. And I remember being involved, he had built a set in his loft with the jail. You've heard of this, maybe. And
vaguely, but maybe.
Yeah, so he was, you know, he just shot, he was shooting film, too, which was sort of amazing. And we were all characters, but it was all rather free-form and, you know, I don't know. I don't think I ever really have seen any of the footage from it. So I think he might be trying to put some of that together. I'm not sure.
I think he's in the process of working on some projects. I don't know which.
Which would be interesting because we're all so much older now. You know, it's like this shocking thing. Because that was when we were in our 20s. And now we're all like in our 50s.
Yeah.
So, you know, we all, you know, be... That's shocking to me, actually.
Cool. I just, you know, Tony was one of our Living Legacy Project artists for our 2012-2013 year. Mm-hmm. And what's really nice about this project is, like, the way in which there's so many different facets of mm-hmm. connections between mm-hmm. all these
oh,
people.
Yeah.
And so I just like asking other people who have experiences with
Tony,
Tony or others, you know, about, mm-hmm. about that. When you look at some of your most important influences and mentors, mm-hmm. Would you consider Tony amongst them?
Oh yes, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. And what are some? Who are some other artists who have influenced you, or people who have influenced you?
Yeah, I think I just flashed on John Spakowski,
mm-hmm.
who I don't know if you've heard that name
no.
or no. He was a curator at Buffalo, Media Study Buffalo, the one that was downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And he did this whole big comedy show. There were like, you know, 20 nights of comedy videotapes,
mm-hmm.
you know, from around, you know, and that actually probably was a big influence on me because I do comic work and just seeing all this stuff from around, and that was a big thing. You know, it was sort of interesting. Tony's like a structuralist in one part of his work,
mm-hmm.
and then the other part becomes more performative and narrative
mm-hmm.
type thing. And so sort of like I see the influences on my own work as sort of like the, you know, I'm always sort of conscious of sort of the structure and,
mm-hmm.
and how it looks,
mm-hmm.
and which was also probably John Hann, and sort of the entertainment value, let's say the entertainment, I would say the entertainment value, the humor and the performative part of it is, you know, so it was sort of, yeah, you know, like I made this one tape called I Just Want to Be a Structuralist Filmmaker where I talk about, you know, about that bit where
mm-hmm.
it would be easier to do that than to make something with any content.
Right. Or better to talk about you just want to be a structuralist filmmaker, maybe in some ways, than to have it more layered underneath
yeah.
all of it rather than just being explicit
yeah.
in that way.
Yeah.
And that's one thing that when I was talking to Ron about your work, that he mentioned, he's like, you know, humor is so central to everything that you do. And do you see, where do you see the root of that coming from?
Okay, well, like that, one of those first film shows, you know, at UB, student film shows, and I would show something, and people would laugh, you know, and they made funny stuff, and it was just like, I love hearing people laugh at my work, oh my god, I'm making people laugh, you know, and I was like, that was such a drug,
yeah,
that was good.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's like getting to tell a great joke that can tell itself
uh-huh.
at different points, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, wonderful.
So,
who is there anyone else you'd like to mention as maybe important influences on like other aspects of the scope of your work or
Well, like John Hann, like he was a graduate student at UV at that point, and he was teaching the intermediate film classes. He was like all, you know, he really wanted things to look really good. But he was like critical of my always going for the joke. So it was funny. Like, I think in the space of a week, I had like, I talked to him, and he was like, well, you always go for the joke, and it's just, you know, why are you always going for the joke? You know, you make these really nice looking films, but then you go for the joke. I'm like, oh. And then I had a meeting with Tony Conrad, and he was like, it's great, you're a comedian, it's great. So, you know, it's like, yeah, that's great. Nothing wrong with going for the joke.
Yeah. And do you feel that you've had to, like, state that in the scope of your career? You know, like, kind of like John was saying, there is this misconception that art needs to be serious.
No, I don't think so, because I think there were, one thing is I saw all those comedy tapes, you know, like, it was a very, you know, making funny videos was not, you know, was not shunned or anything. Definitely not. Even Steina, who makes, you know, her stuff is funny, too, so it was, you know, I didn't have a problem with, only John Hand seemed to have a problem with me making funny stuff.
Did you take any classes with Steina or Woody?
No, they had already gone. Yeah. They had already left. But they're, you know, people talked about them a lot. And they came back to visit. I mean, one time they came back, there was a seminar, a meeting about electronic narrative. And so that was interesting. I sort of met them and saw them then. And, you know, they would come back. People, you know, they were, their presence was always there. Like, Chris Hill had been really heavily influenced by them and then showed their work all the time because it was still at UV and it was, like, one thing they would show. And so I saw a lot of their stuff. So they were definitely, you know, sort of an influence, but not directly. Like, you know, I don't even know if they know who I am. So,
what it does sound like, though, is that there was a very close relationship
between
students and the
professors. For sure, yeah. Most definitely at that point. Yeah, and like the last time I saw Sheritz was many years later, and I was in the Pink, the old Pink.
Uh-huh.
And he asked me to buy him a beer. Just like, yeah, it's like the last time I really had contact with him.
Yeah. That's also kind of wonderful. I mean,
yeah.
You know, the Pink is...
Yeah, the Pink, yeah.
Such a neighborhood staple to think of. Someone who's now reaching, you know, the status of, like, artist as legend.
Mm-hmm.
To think of them in these, you know, in your life, in these spaces
right.
that you still frequent.
Yeah.
Is very humbling.
Yeah.
For him, you know.
Yeah.
Do you find that his work had any influence on you? I mean, his work certainly wasn't funny.
Part of me thinks that he would actually like to have had funny work. He was, like, really into... He was a pretty funny guy in his way. Yeah, you know, what was so shocking is that when he died, he was only in his 50s, I think. And he just seemed so much older, you know, because of everything. So I don't know when you... Like, I could almost say, like, time... Paul Sheritz is my age. He'd been dead for 3 years or whatever. I know. That old joke. You know, like, sometimes I have used repetition and stuff like that, but not quite. I mean, I enjoy it, actually. You know, definitely enjoy it. Whether it's something that has influenced me so much. Maybe somebody else would think more, but his life influenced me more as opposed to, like, not going there. Yeah. And it'd be easy to go there sometimes.
Move on to our next question.
Yeah.
You've touched on how humor is integral into your work, but can you talk about your art and what you create and why you create it, you know, in as general or specific terms as you want? I know. That's
well, like I said, I like making people laugh. So that's really key. It was something that I seemed to have, you know, I did well. And that's sort of nice to have something that you do well and do it. I mean, it's, you know, and it's something that, you know, I enjoy doing. And, you know, it's sort of sad that I haven't really been doing it lately because, you know, there's been, like, all these health reasons. So it's like I want to get back to doing it because it does make me feel good to do it and to show it. There's, like, yeah, definitely, I hope, a feminist aspect to my work, you know, even though a lot of it is, you know, some of it's dealing with, you know, bad romances, and I'm a straight woman, so it's about that. But I like my work to be very accessible to people, that they will see some aspect of their own existence in it, you know, and that actually makes people laugh, too, you know, the recognition that they can have. Like, I wouldn't want to have something that was so, you know, personal that no one else could relate to it. So it wouldn't be that. That's not very interesting to me. So that would be, yeah, broader. I have a lot of trouble talking about my art, my work.
Which is why you have a biographer.
Yes, you can talk about it and make them. I was just thinking about, in terms of, you know, who else I was also making work in Buffalo at that point. It was like, you know, Julie Zandow. You know, we actually had, I think, worked on things together, definitely collaborated or helped one another more than anything else. You know, she was making very similar sort of funny work, and then it sort of turned and went this other way. And I never went, you know, she got very, you know, philosophy and, you know, the French philosophers and all that. She became rather, you know, involved in that whole scene. And I was, really didn't like that. In fact, I made a tape about it, sort of, about, you know, Jacqueline Nocal, who's, it's a bit of a parody about that. So, you know, and that was sort of, you know, I was, you know, Tony was in that, you know, reading all that stuff, and I was just too lazy, you know, I would say I was too lazy to read it, you know, but it just didn't really appeal to me, because I thought I would always find things about it that I just disagreed with heartily, so I thought that was interesting, there was, like, so much of that being made then, too, so some of my work was a reaction to that. You know, the autobiographical part of it is, but trying to be open about it. And,
which seems to focus on interpersonal relationships, mm-hmm. to a degree, right?
Mm-hmm.
Within your work.
And, yeah.
But I agree that it's in a way that is, it's not just about your interpersonal relationships, it's about all interpersonal relationships, especially between, you know, men and women, or cis men and cis women, in that sort of way, you know? But very much inspired by your lived experiences.
Yeah.
You know.
So now I'm, like, halfway married, so, like, what am I going to do?
Do you feel that sometimes it can... I mean, for somebody who has focused a lot on positives and negatives of interpersonal relationships, but do you feel there's some things that are too real, too close for you to touch on?
Amy?
Yeah.
I mean, like, actually, I mean, like, the thing is, maybe I could do something about, you know, about old married life, you know?
Yep.
I mean, that would actually be... Okay, thank you. I should write that down in my hand.
That's right, I'll send you the interview.
That would be, people would identify with that.
Absolutely. And it's, and that's so hilarious, right?
Yeah.
Like, old married couples are pretty funny.
Yeah, that's true.
Even just reading some of what your biographer, Ron Emke, has written about you, or has compiled what has been written about you.
Yeah.
I really like what your friend Elizabeth Licata said when she said that, you know, you are a goddess of small things, where there seems to be a lot of attention to the minute details. Mm-hmm.
I like working, you know, again, perhaps it's just, you know, laziness, but, you know, working on a table with small objects is definitely easier than getting people to come over and try to remember lines or... I mean, I actually did try that one time, and I was really bad at it, so I was just like, no, that's it. I go back to just, you know, working from my, you know, living room.
Do you find that gives you more control?
Yeah, oh yeah. I like, you know, and then I can have all the control I want and not have to, you know, hire somebody to do lighting and sound and all that. I can just do it myself. I'm, control freak.
Yeah.
In a way, about my, you know, that's why I've never been really good about collaborating. Meg Knowles is always trying to get me to collaborate with her, and I'm just like, I'm not very good at this.
In the same way, it probably feels really good to know your strengths. I think it's also really important to know what's not your strengths.
Yeah.
You know, and to be able to, like, say that concisely, because otherwise things get messy.
Yeah.
Another thing that Ron was talking about was how sometimes you do integrate your versions of yourself as a character.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, the Jacqueline O'Cowell, In fact, I'm thinking of, another 25 years on, let's see what Jacqueline's up to now. Even though I was sort of playing somebody who was probably my age then, even though say it wasn't. But, yeah.
Well, that'd be cool if you'd then played somebody 20 years older or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. She's 90. Well, no, 70. Yeah. That's interesting.
Nice. What I like about these interviews is that often, like, I have all these explicit, like, questions, but really things come out just in conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, so as I kind of look back over these things, I'll be like, oh, we touched on that. But I do want to ask you a little bit more about the period when maybe you were out of college, maybe you weren't, but how you got involved with Squeaky Wheel and how you got involved with the founding of Squeaky Wheel and how that played a role in your life at that time, you know, and in your work.
What happened is,
because that was...
It was about the downfall of Media Study Buffalo. The downfall. And, you know, and when my roommates at the time actually was the receptionist there, and she was there when the feds came in and blocked the doors, and I told her to get her purse and to leave. Yeah. But then what happens is that they didn't lock the back door, I guess. And people who... she probably... unnamed people came and took a lot of the equipment away, what was left, and sort of just hid it in places, I guess. So then we had, like, meetings, and Tony Conrad was definitely, you know, spearheading the whole thing.
And was this about, what, like, 84?
Yeah, 86.
Okay, 86.
86, 87. I went away for, like, a year. I went to Oklahoma and taught there. So it was sort of... But Spooky Bill was pretty well set up by that point, I think. And, you know, we just sort of met. And, you know, and it was like... Media Study Buffalo was extremely well funded by the NEA and NISCA.
That was part of the problem, right?
Right. And, like, I remember hearing that John Spikowski, who was the curator of video art, was making, like, $30,000 at that point. And that was like, oh, my God, that's probably the equivalent of, like, $70,000 today. You know, they had so much money. Like, you know, the curators of Tall Walls were making, like, $10,000, if maybe not even that, you know? And they probably still they probably make $30,000 now. But anyway... And it was sort of like the haves and have-nots in some ways, you know. And then, you know, we didn't know, I don't think anybody really knew how much money there was there, going there until it was done. And then they found out, like, oh, my God, you know, it's like, you know, it's $100,000 or more money, you know, lots of money coming in to Media Study Buffalo that wasn't coming in anymore. And their equipment access program was good. It was expensive, and I wasn't, you know, I was going to school at the time, so I didn't really need it. So, so that was, you know, not that important to me. But then I was out of school, and then it was important to me. So, you know, and editing at that point was like, to have access to editing system was everything, because there weren't that, there were, like, you know, three in Buffalo, and you know, I could still probably go up to school and do something, and I could go, you know, I think Caldwell's got theirs, but I don't know when they got theirs.
But it wasn't like having a program on your computer.
No, it's not, you know, and it's sort of like, and now it's like I have, you know, more access to do that at home, and I haven't been doing it, even though it was like, you know, so maybe it was like having to go someplace in the middle of the night and pack a lunch and stay up all night to be able to edit made me, you know.
You had to be invested, right?
Yes, you had to be invested, and that was the time, and it was, like, a lot of focus, and then, you know, if it's in your living room on the table, then it's psychologically that's an interesting idea. Well, anyway, I should think about that. Because I really, loved going and working all night and editing and stuff. And it was different than, doing it in your house, staying up all night, which I have also done. I prefer going. And maybe I need a studio. That's what I need. But back to the split up and Squeaky Wheels. Well, Squeaky Wheel then, there were all these meetings. I remember, all these people involved. I mean, the first meeting was at the artist gallery. There's some pictures of that around. And then it broke off into committees and started, and then we submitted all the grants to NISCA. And they gave us, $20,000 or something like that. It wasn't very much, but it was something. Mm-hmm. And they, rented the space, and I think eventually they got some equipment. They got an editing system and some cameras and stuff. And I remember being at a visual studies workshop. I think I must have had, a residency or something, and I brought Bob Doyle, that name from visual studies. Yeah, he was questioning me about it. He was really shocked that this had happened. That they had gotten even any money. This group of Tony Conrad. It's a long story there, but anyway. So I just remember being questioned by him by that. I don't know how much money. Yeah,
that's being the underdogs in this kind of way, right? Scrappy ones where no one's expecting you guys to succeed at all.
Yeah, yeah. So then, Squeaky Wheel has been extremely successful and it's still continuing to be, really successful, and that's really great.
Yeah.
There were some, this complex about the beginning of it with, Julie and this woman, Rachel Wiseman, and that's a long story, not very exciting, really, ultimately. So in a way, it's actually, Media Study Buffalo was sort of it was in this big old hotel downtown, and it was falling apart. There were all these floors above that no one ever went. And there was old swimming pool in the basement. They did sound stuff. And it was sort of cool, but it was sort of like a boys' club. Mm-hmm. That's sort of what I remember about it. It was very much a boys' club, and, Squeaky Wheel was a girls' club.
That's the first time I've heard it put like that. But I really like...
Even though Tony Conrad was so involved, most of the people...
But he's not your traditional old boys club
guy. No, not at all. So it was Chris Hill was rather involved. And there were Brian Springer was involved. And Tony was involved.
Yeah. So make it explicit on the tape, who were some of the main figures at Media Study Buffalo at that time? It was...
Bruce, what's his name? Bruce, he's at the Walker now, Bruce. I can't think of his name.
I don't remember.
Nancy Norwood. Mm-hmm. She was the only girl there. Oh, and Lynn Corcoran, though. Mm-hmm. She was there. She was sort of part of the club. John Spakowski, Ken Rowe mm-hmm. was the equipment guy. Gerald Grady... Mm-hmm. It felt very, very male. James Blue had been, mm-hmm. he died before I was there, but,
Very institutional in certain ways?
Very institutional, it wasn't wild and crazy artist, it was a very...
Even though it was in this really quirky space, it sounds
Oh, definitely. And, there were many, I just remember... One's going to see some British experimental films, in the dead of winter, and it didn't have heat. And they had these big portable heaters, which made it probably 50 degrees. And just sort of sitting there wrapped in coats watching these films. And it was who was in the audience? It was Chris Hill, it was Brian, me, Tony Conrad, and Fred Bakker, I think. We just, four of us watching films. Jerry didn't seem to really think it was important to build an audience. That was one of his things. There were some nice times.
And also one of the things that Squeaky has really excelled at, especially within the past 10 years or more, I don't know what span really, but is educational programming.
Yeah, and Media Study Buffalo had very, very few. Right. of those, you know. Like, actually, I even before I did take a photography class there with but that was just, I didn't really do anything, I don't think. So I did have dark rooms. So I had like photography dark rooms. Mm-hmm. But I don't think I ever went there and used them. I don't remember. I think I just blew it off. Mm-hmm. But it definitely did, you know, mm-hmm. it was Jerry's mind.
Mm-hmm. It was Jerry's baby, right?
It was Jerry's baby. And, you know, and as much as, you know, I have a lot of respect, and if he hadn't been there, like Media City Buffalo at UB wouldn't have been there. And so, you know, he's like a horrible sexist. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, I think he'd like, you know, he would definitely just be on right. that. But, you know, he's.
But really, I mean, yeah, if you even look at the professorship that he had underneath him, mm-hmm. right? Hyper masculine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just remember one time it was after one of the student shows. I went out with a bunch of people, and Jerry was there, and signed to this cheer on Main Street. And somebody there had asked Jerry about Joyce Whalen. She was married to Michael Snow.
Okay.
Here, I'm just doing exactly what he did. And, you know, she's actually this really wonderful filmmaker, and her work is actually, like, a lot more exciting than Michael Snow's. And somebody asked him about her, and, you know, she's just, you know, on base, he didn't say it so much like it's on his coattails, but on Michael Snow's coattails, but, and I think that's been sort of disproven, you know, so, well, anyway, so that's, I just remember sitting there going, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Your
yeah. yeah. So, but anyway.
Nice. Thank you for opening up about all that. Just because it's interesting, as some people are no longer seen as people and seen as myth or
mm-hmm.
larger than life. You right. know, the nuances of their characters are often lost. And so, don't have to yell it loud, but just putting it out there that this person was three-dimensional and flawed. Mm-hmm. And I find that incredibly important. So I wanted to ask you about some of your work with, like, Art Waves that you did. And that was...
Oh, wow, yeah.
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 And that was in... I looked this up. That was in 1989 through 1991.
Yeah.
And that was with Squeaky Wheel.
Uh-huh. Right? Yeah, we did the News Diaries, which was also, like, a Tony Conrad It was great fun. We had so much fun doing those. You know, it was just like, well, there was a group called the 8mm News Collective. And we would meet like on Monday nights at Squeaky Wheel, the old Squeaky Wheel. You know, we were telling the news that wasn't on the news type thing. And Tony brought up the fact that, like, you know, and it's still so true today that the news, like, thinks of itself as being the news. And especially local news, right? And so we decided to follow, you know, we would pick a station and we would follow the reporters when they went out. We would hang out outside their studio. We had Wago Krieger had this old VW bus, and Tony had gone and gotten a bunch of seersucker, like, jackets, like suit jackets, seersucker, white, and maybe some other color, blue, light color seersucker. It's summer, so it made sense to wear seersucker. And so we wore all, you know, we had this little uniform, and we had our little, you know, 8mm cameras that were, and we would follow them around. You know, and at first, the first few times it happened, they were just sort of like mystified. And then, of course, then they caught on and got really mad and sort of like, we're going to call the cops. And so then it was all over. But, you know, they couldn't understand that they were the news. You know, that they just couldn't comprehend, even though they were so full of themselves about, you know, it was, you know, it was wonderful, actually. And, and actually, we knew a person or two that worked there, and they were, like, you know, trying to distance themselves from us. Because, you know, I guess it was a big thing, you know. We were like clowns following them, you know. They shouldn't, yeah. But we had cameras, though, that probably was
And that's totally fascinating how it messes with the idea of, like, the expert or the connoisseur or something that, right?
Yeah, they were like, we're the news people. Who are you? You're not. You can't be the news. And how can we be the news, you know? You are the news. You know.
It's very Dada-esque, too.
Yes, it was. Yeah. And then some of the people actually did a follow-up on it. And I can't remember what it was. I wasn't involved in for some reason. So, and actually, this was the time of the first Gulf War. Really interesting. And then I also did Art Waves. We did the Brenda and Glenda show. It was a these two performance artists from New York City had come up for the Ways of Being Gay. And they had a TV show in New York City. So we made like three shows with Brenda and Glenda. They were drag artists. And so we followed them around Buffalo in drag during the Ways of Being Gay thing. And
that was in the early 90s.
We went to Niagara Falls. And, huh?
That was early 90s, right?
Yeah.
It was just a very different cultural climate.
Yeah, it was more free, wasn't it? Yeah.
Well, it depends. I mean, I guess I'd have to defer to you on that.
I don't know. Like, yeah. Well, like, Hall Walls had a big, you know, big gay, like, 2 weeks of, or a month of stuff, and it was like a big deal. But this was also at the time of all the abortion protests in Buffalo, too, so that was, yeah. But, you know, Buffalo, we're like 20, no, no, we're 96 on the list of
Bible 94. Funding, right?
Yes, yes, so we're pretty good.
Yeah. Speaking of Buffalo, I wanted to ask you about the Buffalo aesthetic in film and video art, and maybe what that looks like to you as someone who's been involved in that community for a very long time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, at first, what it was is that, like, people didn't have that much equipment, you know? So we had to make do without having all this splashy box-in-box things going around and stuff like that, which actually I think was a good thing, ultimately. You know, like, there was for a while, like, a big, there's always been sort of film versus video was a real big thing when I was, you know, in school and stuff. Like, you had to sort of almost choose one, you know? And now it's just all media and no one really gives a damn, hopefully, anymore. You know, it's definitely, you know, like, you had to make your own titles because there wasn't a title-making, you know, machine in town that we had access to. So, you know, so your title, you had to be creative. You had to, like, write it on a piece of paper or something. And, you know, like, you had to play around with, you know, that. If you wanted to have some titles or on your thing, you had to. So it was just, like, a little, it's definitely a little more down and dirty and not, I mean, it used to be like you would go to New York City and you'd get these special grants and you'd have to go to the big production house and do like a half, you know, an inch edit and, you know, like it was like a big deal. And I never did any of that. I think Julie Zando did and some other people did too. You know, it's using the least amount of equipment that you can and still producing something that's, you know, good. I'm sorry. You know, and it's about making work that, you know, a lot of it is, you know, has been political and definitely, there's definitely a lot of politics, political work, having to deal with gender and
but maybe the relationship between the sort of, like, grittier form of representation, which I totally see.
Yeah.
Between that sort of grittier representation and the perspective of Buffalo as a sort of avant-garde center of creativity, especially within the late 70s and the 80s.
I mean, one thing is that no one ever really felt bad about being in Buffalo. No one ever really felt like, I mean, maybe there were some people who do
you know, like painters feel like, oh, I can't be in Buffalo and be a painter. I've got to go to New York City. And actually at that time, you probably had to go to New York City. But it seemed like there was enough of a community in Buffalo that we didn't really have to go to New York City. Yeah. And, you know, we could go visit New York City, we could show our work. I mean, we had shows in New York City sometimes. But we didn't have to. It was nice not having to go to New York City to become recognized. Like, we could definitely, like, Julie Zando, like, became extremely well recognized. Mm-hmm. And she didn't ever live in New York City. That was nice, you know, because it's so much easier to, it's very laid back to live in Buffalo as opposed to living in New York City.
Very affordable in different ways.
Yeah, and you could really, you know, spend probably more time on your work than if you lived in New York City where you had to get a job and you had to find an apartment, and just living there is so much harder.
Especially today. When I went to New York for a conference like months ago, I went to the Anthology Film Archives, mm-hmm. you know, just talking to them about the role of Buffalo mm-hmm. in media art. You know, it's, they speak so highly about it.
Yeah.
And just like the quality of the creative works that were coming out of Buffalo. And certainly, I guess that environment's changed because, you know, it's really great hearing, it's really great and fascinating hearing you talk about how difficult it was to edit your works or to have the equipment necessary mm-hmm. to do these things. Now, all those things are even more accessible than mm-hmm. they were, which in some ways might mean that we need New York even less, or you need to be in New York even less. And yet, we don't have that. It's not the same environment that it was, you know.
Yeah, it's not, you know, sort of sad, but moved away.
Yeah.
You know, one big reason there's not enough work, you know, to pay the bills.
Yep.
And that's sort of sad. I mean, Tony Conrad's gone back to live in, you know, in New York City more or less, for whatever reasons. Yeah, last time I ran into Tony was at Roswell Park. He was waiting to get his, like, yearly infusion of the bone strengthening
like osteoporosis medicine,
medicine and just regularly. So you know, so that was actually rather poignant, you know, meeting him, because I did this leukemia thing and was, you know, probably getting infused and I could, you know, with bloods and stuff, and so it was good to see him, though. We talked for, like, you know, 15 minutes or so.
Again, and that's so
ironic that we met there.
Yeah, and that's so Buffalo in this way.
It's true.
You know?
Yeah.
What I do want to ask you, too, is, you know, what I wanted was for you to describe what you see as the Buffalo aesthetic, and then maybe talk about where you see your work fitting into that.
Well, as I was saying, it's, you know, sort of a low-tech type thing. Sort of low-tech, but... Like, my own work, I like to think of as being low-tech, but it's not really about being low-tech. It just is low-tech. And, you know, then it's just, you know, like, I'm out there with my little camcorder, and, you know, so I should start using my iPhone to tape things and start thinking that. You know, it's small things too. I mean, that's my own work, and that's. But then also, like, I was involved with Ladies of the Lake, the feminist theater group, and did their video for, like, a long time. So I have those. But that was very collaborative. You know, I would never call that, like, my work. That's something I worked on, but with a lot of other people. But again, like, you know, that was sort of like a crossover of different people who were involved in that, too. It sort of evolved from a, you know, a very supportive community, you know, where you could show your work to somebody and they would say, oh, no, that's not good. Or, yeah, that's good. You should do this or you should do that. And, you know, like, you always felt, I mean, that's really nice to be able to have those filters there, you know. To be able to show it to Tony or show, you know, I know that I really did that too much, but I would show it and then, you know.
Mm-hmm. To be more than just, like, fawning support or...
Yeah, it was definitely. But then there are also a lot of people who came in and out of Buffalo to teach at UV or or to show at hall walls or residencies or whatever there were. So there were, like, a lot of outside influences that would happen, but maybe they were all like, well, we're not going to go there. You know, like, there was also a feeling that, you know, we didn't want to be like those people. Like, I always tell the story about, I guess, Bill Viola came to town, and he wouldn't show his work on the monitors they had at UB because they weren't good enough.
So a big part of maybe the Buffalo...
But that's a story I heard from somebody else. I wasn't there.
Fair. Good to say.
But, you know, but it was always sort of like, you know, they would tell that story, and it was just like, you know, don't you ever be like that, you know?
Don't be pretentious.
Don't be pretentious. Actually, it's probably... I mean, there's been lots of pretentious work done, but... but probably not as much as other places, you know, like, yes, that's right. Like, hopefully my work isn't pretentious at all.
I don't think so. I don't think Ron
is. Is it pretentious to even think that? But, yeah, like, no, there's been some pretentious work, but I think there was always sort of, you know, like Tony's work I don't find to be pretentious at all, you know, even though it's, you know... At a very high level, it's
very
not.
It's esoteric at points, it's intellectual, but it's not.
Yeah.
I agree. And I do think that that is one of the qualities of maybe not just the Buffalo media art aesthetic, but just the
Buffalo area.
The Buffalo area.
City of no illusions.
Yeah. Pretension doesn't really last here. And if you are pretentious, you won't really make it.
Yeah, like, I mean, I know, like, you know, I don't go see your... see a piece of work or something, you know, and Meg will say, oh, you would have hated it. It was really pretentious.
You don't even need to be there to see it for them to
right. And like, okay.
And that's my perspective, too, on many things. So is there anything else you'd like to say about your creative process?
I was always, like, really, like, sadly, probably deadline-driven. Like, there'd be a show, and I'd have, oh, I gotta make a tape for that, you know? Or, you know, we're gonna give you a show, you have to make, you know? So then I always had to make work. I'm just, you know, I envy painters and stuff like that. Oh, I get up, and, you know, in the morning and paint all the morning or something like that. And play, you know, and, but yeah, you know, I've got, like, quite a body of work, so I shouldn't be that, like, you know, make stuff now, but, which was interesting, like, it seemed, you know, like, if I painted and had paintings for my, for how much work I've done, it would be very sad. Yeah, it'd be like, you know, five paintings.
Or, it's a different medium.
It's a different medium, you're right. Yeah, I think of my friend Felice painting on her little dots.
Is there anything else you want to say about, like, your creative process?
Or? Oh, no, it's trying to... You know, like, I would, like, hear a snippet about, you know, something about, like, Lacan saying that the father brings language into the house, and then, like, my mind would explode in repulsion at that, and thought that was so horrible, and so then Jacqueline O'Kell got involved, you know, about language, and so. Mm-hmm.
It just is what it is.
So it would just be, like, little things, like, right now... I'm becoming fascinated, and I should probably go out and shoot some of this. I've been watching way too much TV, and there's a show called Above the Alps, or Over the Alps, Above the Alps, and it's like this series of 10-hour-long documentaries about the Alps, and which is interesting because the Alps, many countries are involved in the Alps, but they only highlight the countries that have sponsored this series. So they've been in France is not mentioned, you know, which I find to be humorous. Mm-hmm. But they've taken these, like, really, it's all about, I think, like, the little helicopters and with the cameras to get these really incredible shots and gliders and balloons and stuff to get these, like, incredible shots of these huge mountains. And I've just been so, like, mesmerized. And actually, it's interspersed, though, with these really sort of really... not that well done. Well, they're fairly well done for what they are. Like, when they interview, like, a milk farmer about his cows, and it's, you know, they translate it over him talking, you know, and the translations are very simple, you know. I love my cows, you know. I know everyone by, you know, the ring of its bell. You know, but it was like so simple that I'm sure they're saying a lot more than they're saying or been told to say. So that's interesting. But I'm just thinking of sort of like the landscapes. And now I'm looking at the snow outside and thinking, that could look really amazing. And it's just a lump of snow. Mm-hmm. So
maybe it'd be fun shooting too to see. I'm sorry.
No.
From more of a moving away from like discussing your artworks and your creative processes into sort of art as career, could you talk a little bit about what you've done personally to advance your career in the arts?
Ron Epke and I always talk about, like, actually, we were always going to get together with this woman, Annie Ferguson, and we were going to have this little club, and we would meet every, you know, week and describe what we've done to further our careers and where we've sent things, and we've never done that. So I'm just really bad. I mean, I used to send stuff out, like, regularly, and I would, you know, show stuff. But I haven't done that yet. In fact, I don't even, like, I've got to get my stuff together on a DVD as opposed to it being on VHS, which is, like, the only show copy I have. So, like, I've got to do that, and I've got to do that soon.
I have this one question about what are some of your needs as an artist that the larger community can provide? And just throughout the narrative that we've been talking about, I really got a sense of the role that the community has played in creating a space that allowed you to create the work that you create. Mm-hmm. Are there any other needs that you have that the community could help you with, or that you could get from the community that you're maybe not getting?
Yeah. I mean, other than like the whole migrating media and getting my work into, you know, even like a DVD now is sort of passe, so that's what I need. I mean, like, you know, having a show is nice. No, I can't really think of anything I really need. I feel like I should be giving back more, maybe. Mm-hmm. Actually, maybe that would be good, to give something more about something.
So my last question, if you could go back in time and talk to yourself when you were still in grad school, and if you could tell yourself.
I would tell myself to play the game better, you know, to send out more work and be more, like, diligent about it and not be afraid to do that and to definitely good, yeah. Oh, my God. Send stuff out. You know, be diligent. And I think I had some awkward things happen where, like, somebody gave a tape of mine to Amy Talbin. Have you heard of her?
Vaguely, yeah.
Yeah, and she was a big deal. But it wasn't, like, you know, like, it wasn't a finished tape, you know. It was, like, all these different works, but some of them I wouldn't have given to her, but somebody gave it to her. Besides, you know, didn't ask me. Like, there was something else. Like, you know, like, at one point, tape was expensive, and so then you would have, you know. So, you know, and she saw work that I wouldn't have shown to her. But then she sort of had that influence, you know. Like, I could have, and she wrote me a letter saying, you're not quite there yet. And I'm just like, well, you shouldn't have seen that work. But, like, I should have called her or wrote to her and said, you shouldn't have seen that work. I don't show that work. That was a mistake that you saw that. You know, that was early stuff. That's not me. You know, I was sort of shy about those things. And I shouldn't have been shy about those things. Yeah.
I mean, maybe this is sort of related, but when, like, Hal Hartley.
Oh, yeah, Hal Hartley. He had just graduated, I think, from graduate school. And there was, like, this big SUNY film and video show thing at UB, sponsored again by Jerry. You know, like, Jerry's been so so influential that I shouldn't, you know, say anything bad about him. But he's so influential. And so he had this big show, and so, like, all the people from SUNY schools came. And Hal Hartley came. He was, like, one of the, I remember him. And he showed something, and it was like, you know, like, he was just on the cusp of becoming, you know, Hal Hartley. And he, you know, and I had shown some work, and I don't remember what it was. But he came up to me and said, oh, you're, you know, really good stuff, you know. And, like, I'm like, wow. So, I mean, and that was, you know, but actually it wasn't wow, but it was just like, who is this guy?
But then I found it was Hal Hartley. Like, I remember the name, and then when he became, oh, you know, seeing his movies, going, oh, he liked my work. I like his work. So that was nice, yeah.
And a reminder that, you know, again, like, sometimes these artists seem larger than life, mm-hmm. but really they're just different people producing different types of work.
Yeah, and he actually wrote a little blurb for the back of my catalog because, you know, Julie Zando curated that, had, you know, written to him and asked him to. He was too busy at that point to write anything more.
Oh, Jody, okay, well, I'm out of questions. Is there anything else that you'd like to touch on before we conclude?
No, I can't think of it. I feel exhausted.
We do hit on a lot of points, but really...
Yeah. It's you know, I'll be thinking in the car on the way home.
Thank you so much for coming in to conduct a Living Legacy Project interview with us. Mm-hmm. And we really look forward to working with you in the future.
Okay.
Future endeavors.